Almighty and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Thursday, 28th of May, 2020, meeting of Parliament, order of proceedings. Confirmation of minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 20th of March, 2020.
May I find the minutes of court?
In the case from the chair, particularly announcing the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it's my pleasure to welcome all members back to Parliament for this May 2nd. The Parliament, since we have been elected in the parliamentary period of Brexit, has met on a monthly basis, other than in April. And despite the convoluted times in which we live, this year to date, starting this session now in May, we have met every month except April. And I want to, in particular, welcome you back to Parliament. Because last time we met, we had to make do with a presiding officer who gave me an extraordinarily rough time. So it's a pleasure to see your balance back in the chair. If it's any consolation to speak, I'd make sure I can hear it from our left-handed cabinet. Mr. Speaker, the time since this Parliament last met has been one that will be talked of for many years. It has been a time that will be referred to in our history for generations to come. When we again see the deal last time, my final words to the Parliament then were that the community should brace itself. It's quite something that the senior elected political leader of the community actually used those words in peacetime in this house. But that is where we were on the 20th of March of this year, Mr. Speaker. We knew that we were as ready as possible then for the arrival of a wave of COVID-19 in Gibraltar. We knew that we had to hope for the best, and we knew that we were prepared for the worst. But even in that situation, we were clear. We did not want to lose any Gibraltarian or any resident of Gibraltar to the coronavirus. And now, we know that we have not. I would just say, Mr. Speaker, that unfortunately, we are aware of at least one case in which a Gibraltarian was lost to COVID away from Gibraltar. It is no consolation for us that one of our people has succumbed to the virus, even if this was half an hour before. And as we left this place in late March, Mr. Speaker, the government had come before the House in high gear. We left to move into even higher gear. Probably the highest gear in which a government has had to operate in the period of civilian government in Gibraltar. And I make no apology, Mr. Speaker, for again praising the public sector for the way it has reacted to the call for action that we have caused to undertake. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I want to tell the House that the reaction of Gibraltar to this crisis has been exemplary. And it is not just us who say so. Advisors to the World Health Organization have said so. In this week's edition of The Economist, there is praise for Gibraltar in two separate articles for the introduction of our golden hour, or our golden generation, the over 70s. And the proof of that is not just in a speech, but an article, in an argument, or any metaphysical aspect. It is in the pudding of reality. In the absence of casualties to date from the virus in our community. It is in the fact that our health services were not overwhelmed. And it is in the extraordinarily low numbers of infections that we have seen reported amongst the resident population. Even now, as we're doing even more random testing than most places in the world, we're seeing almost no community transmission. Yet in those early days, as we braced, we had no crystal ball to point us to the extraordinary success that we have now seen today. In fact, we have every indicator pointing in the direction of massive potential casualties. We have every reason to fear that we might have lost many of our most loved ones, in particular in the vulnerable demographic sector. And we have every reason to work harder than ever to preserve the lives of our fellow countrymen. Life was turned upside down. First, restaurants and bars were closed from 8 p.m. No mean feat, as we actually did that on a Friday afternoon. Yet we saw everyone comply. The importance of complying, of working for Team Gibraltar rather than for personal profit at stake, was clear to every operator. All responded admirably, despite the likelihood of huge financial losses as a result. The Cabinet met over the weekend, together with the leader of the opposition, who was present for our deliberations. We resolved to pass regulations to confine our over 70s. We declared a major incident and established tiers of command and reporting. We closed catering establishments completely, not just after 8 p.m. We introduced a full text message from the government to ensure that the issue of the numbers of infections was not one for unhinged speculation on social media. And that continues to this day and has proven the reliable index of numbers for our people when it comes to the prevalence of the virus in our community. I want to thank Chief Telecom for that excellent work. We introduced a daily press conference where these numbers were provided to the public and broadcast to the whole nation by the national broadcaster GBC. I want to thank the men and women of GBC for really stepping up. A daily live press conference was an unimaginable standard for us all before this emergency, but we achieved it. Newspapers stepped up and introduced free deliveries for the over 70s and government elderly houses. Thank you to them too for the information and entertainment they will have provided. I personally record the thanks of the people of Gibraltar to editors Brian Hayes of the Gibraltar Chronicle and Gary Garcia Senior of Panorama for their magnificent initiative. To everyone who's working together, clubbing together to get through this in a way that was designed to ensure that we were all rowing in the same direction, undistracted from the main matter at hand. We developed a Nightingale Hospital work on track. Particular thanks to Stuart Benson and his team for the work they did on that, as well as the Royal Gibraltar Regiment, who, under a NACA request, assisted also. We opened a new ICU, which is mercifully now closed. And we were on the cusp of a government of national union. It's worth just pausing over that issue in this case, Mr. Speaker. The enormity of what we were facing was such that we were both governments and opposition ready to consider that possibility. Today, in the sunny uplands of late May, with no casualties to COVID, some might consider, might wonder and not understand how we might even have considered that. But it's important to look at where we were. We were looking at estimates of hundreds or thousands of Gibraltarians dead in a period of a few short weeks or months. We had to develop the capability to bury mass numbers of people. We had to develop a new war facility. We had to stop religious worship. And the speaker, on the 23rd of March, we locked down our whole population. We restricted civil liberties in a way I would never have wished for, but which became essential. We restricted rights that I sworn an oath to protect. And we restricted the operation of those parts of our constitution which we have fought through the decades of the civilian inhabitants of this one community forced to endure. But it had to be done. And our people have almost universally understood and accepted that. This is the first time in our history that the civilian authorities of Gibraltar have restricted the movement of Gibraltarians in Gibraltar. So within that dramatic developing context, that the two historic political rivals, the GSLP Liberals and the GSP bound political weapons, work together. I understood the importance of reaching out to my opposite number on the opposition benches, and the Honourable Leader of the Opposition understood the importance of accepting our call. If the worst of the events we had been told to expect had come to pass, we would today likely be sitting in government together. I have cleared with His Excellency the Governor, and I think it is important to record in the past, and have communicated to the Leader of the Opposition that a proper interpretation of the Constitution permitted the appointment of 10 ministers alongside a chief minister. I was therefore able to bring Mr. Sabaldi in as a minister without having to remove one of the existing portfolio holders. We were close, but in the end, it was happily not necessary. Not because we would not have been able to work together, but because we did not see the worst material. And we found, Mr. Speaker, also a way of working together without that final step. We were, I think, both pleased to have been able to avoid crossing that Rubicon, but it's an illustration of just how dangerous the position potentially was. A GSLP chief minister was considering offering executive responsibility in a GSLP liberal government to a GSB leader. And to boot, one of the team of 1996. It's saddening, Mr. Speaker, when I read ill-informed comments by a few ill-informed commentators that suggest that this has been a low period for our democracy. The opposite is true, and anyone who understands the detail of democracy understands that it requires moments of unity, and not that in key moments people should continue to oppose for the sake of it, as if that were a necessary mark or criteria for democracy. There is time for all that. There is also time for unity. I thank Honourable Members opposite for their support and the Honourable Leader of the Opposition in particular. I invited him to address our people alongside me in a press conference at Members' Common Place in a fitting, historic, visual representation of the unity that we achieved in the common front that we have maintained. That moment, I think, is one that will live on in the political history of our nation for many generations, as it was as unlikely before as it was unprecedented. As I said in the last meeting, when we try to galvanize the spirit of cooperation going forward, is only to purge our debate of the more personal reflections we have seen in the past. But I'm a realist, too. Let's see whether we can at least avoid calling each other names for the next few hours. And if the government and the opposition worked together, so did many other things. Mr. Speaker, the COVID Economic Liaison and Advisory Council, which I established as a result of the emergency budget that I brought to the House at the last session, has included representatives of sometimes competing interests. Unions and business representative organizations have worked together to advise the government in a way that has been helpful. Staff members are not thought of commitments themselves, but they have been attending meetings assiduously, although the meetings are lengthy. And all of them have given their time. Each has acted for their own organisations, but with a Gibraltar-first attitude, which is commendable and which I refer to the House for that reason. I thank all members of that committee on behalf of the government and people of Gibraltar. They helped us to develop our measures for business and our deep COVID measures to put a shield around employees and employment in this difficult time. We were able to agree those also with the leader of the opposition and the Honourable Mr. Clinton. And the machinery of government delivered on those new commitments and obligations in a remarkable way. Publishing regulations and guidance in record time, and translated, indeed, into various relevant languages. A remarkable effort led by the Financial Secretary, the Commissioner of Income Tax, the Director of Employment and the Accountant General. Their teams have been better than superb, as have our government law officers, who have been called upon to draft regulations at short notice in the period of the last 12 weeks. In this time, Mr. Speaker, I met with the Prime Minister and spoken to the Foreign Secretary and the Minister for Europe, the latter on a number of occasions. I spoke also to the Spanish Minister for the Interior and to the Spanish Foreign Secretary, as well as to the President of the Hungarian Embassy. Political contact has been fluid, and the frontier has not been a safe point in a manner that has been designed to prejudice Gibraltar as it might have been in the past. That, too, is an enormous success. And so now, as we reflect on where we are, how we managed to get here, and how we will move forward, it is clear that there is much to do. We're already working on a new Unlock the Rock document, a second document from this Restart and Recover Passport, which will be issued in early July and will deal with the process to come out from Rock Unlocked on the 1st of August. I anticipate a final part of the Unlock the Rock series, which will be a third instalment that will be delivered in late summer and will be from Task Force Future. We will have to consider together how we deal with the extended financial year, which is our programme to run to the end of September. I will certainly be announcing how we propose to continue to support businesses and individuals beyond the 30th of June. I do not, however, Mr. Speaker, want to anticipate questions on the order paper that we have which deal with the brief COVID measures. Mr. Speaker, I've said many thanks already in the context of the past weeks. I said many thanks already in the context of your speech. I have many more thanks to give. In particular, some in the public sector who are not often seen, but who have demonstrated how essential they are to the smooth working of Gibraltar, even in these difficult times. From refuge collectors to our port operators and our port launch crews, our teachers, our LSAs, our cleaners, all of them, the professional grade, the technical grade, everyone has given their best. The best of Gibraltar have given their best to Gibraltar, and we have seen the best of the Gibraltarians in these times. That is what has delivered success. I hope we will continue to see that from every sector in our community. But the speaker, there are hidden gems of things that have happened in the past 12 weeks, but I hope we'll be able to shed more light on in coming days and weeks. For example, the small private plane that flew directly to China and from China to Gibraltar to bring us PPE when it wasn't available anywhere else. It was piloted by a Gibraltarian, by Mark Guerrero, twice to China and back. These are remarkable achievements, Mr. Speaker, that are not on the front pages of our newspapers, but must be at the forefront of our minds as we understand how we have achieved what we have achieved in the past 12 weeks. Mr. Speaker, the staff of our civil contingency committee have been absolutely remarkable. Ivor Lopez, Wayne Barton, Peter Vanino, and Brian Brook have been, I think, permanently in our civil contingency bunker at Chamber 6 in the Situation Room. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, the work that has been done in the GHO. My interface in the GHO is the Minister for Health, for Varane. But everyone in the GHO, Chris Rowell, the Acting Medical Director, Sahil Bassi, the Director of Public Health, and every single person in the GHO, from the cleaners to the security guards to the doctors to the nurses, every single level of responsibility in the GHO has stepped forward and been ready to help the water through the process. We need to understand that there are people in what we call the COVID ICU, or the dirty ICU, or the COVID John ward,
waiting for the virus to arrive to deal with it. But he was shying away from it and trying to shield ourselves from it. So there's a group of Gibraltarians who stood ready to face the virus and to ask for it to be brought to them so that they could work to save the lives of those suffering with the virus. That is remarkable bravery, Mr. Speaker. Much greater bravery than standing up to make an argument in a rarefied place like this. Much greater bravery, Mr. Speaker, than sitting at the head of a platoon in command and making decisions which one is asked to make. This is front-line bravery, Mr. Speaker, and this House must recognize that, and we must recognize it in a more permanent way than just in these speeches, and I will be inviting the leaders of the opposition to consider with me how we might do that in coming weeks and months. And in the people, Mr. Speaker, who supported the GHA, for example, all those who went out of their way to make a contribution to the GHA, those associations who decided that they wanted to put their hands in their collective or personal pockets, because they're not really individual businesses, and they wanted to give, because the health authorities around the world were saying none of us have enough ventilators in order to deal with this. Then people suddenly thought, well, how can I help to get a ventilator? How can I help to get the remarkable inflow, Mr. Speaker, of unsolicited money to the GHA has been absolutely incredible. And then indeed, Mr. Speaker, whether it's BBC, who organized an ad hoc open day and collected over £100,000. I think it was £178,000 in addition to everything else. This support is more than just remarkable. And really, Mr. Speaker, whether it's that or the rainbow postcard received by some in our GHA from 7-year-olds and 70-year-olds, the support has been absolutely remarkable. It really does make one wonder, Mr. Speaker, whether the heroes of the modern world are not the guys who kick the ball in the gladiatorial arena of football, but the guys who save lives wearing their PPE in great discomfort in the hospitals of the world. And then, Mr. Speaker, moving on to other work done, for example, by our civil contingency team and the North Community Association, RDC, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office all working together to ensure two extractions from Morocco, one of them brought to Gibraltar by the Port Launch Crew and the RDP Launch Crew. Mr. Speaker, that has been absolutely remarkable work, and seeing that in action has demonstrated what this community is capable of when it needs to be capable of it. Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely right, therefore, that the many sung and unsung heroes of the past 12 weeks should be recognized for the work that they have done, and that is why I think it would be appropriate for this Parliament to recognize that in some appropriate way. Mr. Speaker, too often I spend time thanking those who have been on the front line, but not too often because I can't do it too often. But it is incumbent on me also, Mr. Speaker, to make a personal reflection of thanks to all who sit on these benches alongside me, to all of the ministers that I have been working with. Mr. Speaker, the cabinet that was called in the centre of Brexit was ready to deliver this success in the battle against COVID because we are a team that works together. And work, Mr. Speaker, is what has most defined every one of the people who sit alongside me on these benches in the past 12 weeks. Mr. Speaker, if I have to single out two individuals in particular, it would of course be the Minister for Health and the Minister for Civil Contingency. I don't know that the Manchester Member has actually slept in the past 12 weeks, but he has certainly been there every moment of every working day, with every regulation to hand, ready to be the interface with the leader of the opposition. If regulations have to be published quickly and we need a feedback because we want us to act together. Or for the line who I think probably enjoyed the use of
from one of those 170 odd beds that we had available in the hospital alongside his team, together with the Minister for Public Health, John Kerr, who has understood the science better than most of us in the context of how this virus arrived and developed, and was our early warning system in the cabinet on the subject of what at one stage might have looked like a bad flu season coming in our direction, and all other ministers who have been dealing with issues that are in terms of financial services and economic development, like the Vizsla and Sergio Rosano, the frontline of education, which is some goodies who I'm starting to forgive for his time as presiding officer. And now, Mr. Speaker, on the front line of our fight against pollution is not the Minister for the Environment, but the Minister for Transport, who I think is relishing the argument that will help us deliver a better and cleaner Gibraltar. And Mr. Speaker, as you've looked at the Unlock the Rock document, probably the longest section, and especially the section that deals with sports, which has its own intricacies and has been a difficult issue to deal with. So my thanks to all of them. Of course, Mr. Speaker, there is one person who has been with me on every step of the way, and that's the President of the Senate. So, Mr. Speaker, it is true that this has been a time of great stress for those who have been confined at home, for those with concerns about their businesses, and for those of us who are in government. It's been a time of great strain for the whole economy and for the whole community. But now, Mr. Speaker, I think it's time that we should also reflect that this is a time of great success. We cannot let our guard down. Our advice has not changed. It is safer to stay at home if one is not out at work, if there is no other good reason to be out. But that is the way that we have taken this first round with the virus, and it will be the way that we keep the virus in every round. It's extraordinary that we've reached the stage with no casualty. It's extraordinary what we've seen Gibraltar do, but there is still the fact that there is a lot of work to do. That doesn't hide the fact, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar is an extraordinary place, and long may that continue to be the case for all of us. Now the work begins, Mr. Speaker, to develop those economic support mechanisms for all our businesses and to continue to try and see as low a set of casualties to unemployment as possible. It is going to be difficult, Peter, and the work that SELEC is doing now is going to be almost as important as the work that it has done, and I do hope that we will be able to move forward together on this matter and those issues. I expect to have feedback from SELEC on a number of new proposals by the end of the week, and then I expect to be able to sit down with the Legal Division and Mr. Clinton to consult them on those new proposed measures. Those will be the measures that go beyond the 30th of June, the period for which we have agreed the next COVID mechanism. Mr. Speaker, what is ahead of us might be even more daunting than what is now beginning. There is an opportunity for a new future. A new future that will require courage and it will require bravery. It will be very easy to fall on the old ways, to pander to the popular and to not take the steps that are the right steps for our community. We are not elected to pander to the popular. We need to move away from that which is just comfortable and we need to stretch ourselves. Perhaps we have stretched ourselves more than anybody expected already in the way that we beat our political weapons into cloudways and delivered the best of each of us in the past 12 weeks. There is an opportunity to do that. There is a requirement to do that. Gibraltar, I think, is planned for us to do that as we go forward in the past. Mr. Speaker, before I sit down, it is incumbent on me to put on the record of the House the solidarity of the people of Gibraltar with those nations around us that have lost citizens to COVID-19. And to those all around the world, whether it is in China where this began, in Italy where we saw it explode in Europe, in our neighbouring Spain, or indeed, Mr. Speaker, in the United Kingdom, own military. Everywhere in the world that has suffered loss to COVID must understand that they have the solidarity of this small nation that has not to date lost anyone to COVID. Speaker, your body was really when he was in your chair, as we rose to a term in a year, told us last time that COVID is the battle we face, and it was a battle we will win. So we tell Mr. Speaker, we're ahead in front. I too want to welcome the return of Parliament. It's been a long time, but an understandable interregnum because of the reasons that the Chief Minister has indicated. And to welcome your return in particular. Not that, of course, the Honourable Mr. Dugiri did not do a good job. Indeed, it has been remarked that he perhaps did a very good job. But we welcome you. Your absence last time was for good reason. At the time, it was a very sensitive period for Gibraltar, and we certainly like to see you back in that chair this morning. I also agree that this has been a historic period, and it's important to understand and to reflect on that historical significance, because when you are in a moment that decades later will be described as historic, sometimes it is not particularly seen. But in years to come, I believe that people will reflect on this particular period, how we dealt with it as a community, and then, of course, if you're ready as to whether it was good or bad, and it's not for certainly. I'm not going to give that verdict today. Historians will do so. I hope they view how we dealt with that crisis in a favourable way. I concur with the Chief Minister's remarks, and I also express our solidarity on this side of the House, speaking for the GFC opposition. For other nations who have lost so many lives, yesterday the United States was about to tip into 100,000 deaths, and there was a program on CNN about all the different stories of people who had lost their lives, and they weren't just the vulnerable, of course. There were people in their 40s who ostensibly were healthy people. And so I think we have been great so far, and I say so far, by the fact that we have not had any fatalities. And the verdict, as far as I'm concerned, is so far so good. And I think it's important when we come to address the issue not to lose sight, not to go crazy, and not to misunderstand the moment where we are at. The moment is not as bad as it was, but it is still required sensitive management going forward. And that is an important theme that people need to understand when they listen to the politicians of the day and indeed the messaging that is going out there. As the Chief Minister has done, I also reflect on where we were on the 13th of March when he told me to have a discussion about the possibility of cooperation with the opposition. That was a moment where the government opened up to us the scientific modelling and advice it was receiving as to the kind of hospitalisation and fatality that it was being advised might be possible. It was, and if you think about where we were, at that stage, it was 10 days after the first confirmed case in Gibraltar. We had, 2 days before, in the opposition, issued a press release asking for comprehensive testing to be adopted as a policy from the government. At that stage, there had only been 49 tests in Gibraltar. When we met the Chief Minister and he described that to us, I was certainly left in no doubt about the potential for a really dark storm in Gibraltar. period that we have never, as a community, had to grapple with. Certainly not something like this. This community has dealt with military sieges, it has dealt with political sieges, it has dealt with war, but it has never dealt with that kind of deep public health crisis, at least in the 20th century, in that way, or at least not since the Spanish flu of the early years of the 20th century. And certainly not dealt with by local politicians, because of course the last time there was the Spanish flu of that magnitude, local institutions had not developed, and there was not even a legislature to develop. So yes, when the Federal Cabinet considered that on the 14th of March, we took an early view that it was absolutely necessary for us to cooperate and work with the government on these matters. And so I attended the special cabinet meeting at which I was invited, and we discussed the social and commercial lockdown. As everyone knows, we came to this house a week later to support an emergency budget at the request of the government to put forward that which would have been absolutely necessary in an unprecedented way, so that the government could concentrate on dealing with the public health crisis. We have been working on economic measures and public health measures, and on civil contingency matters, and all my colleagues have been engaged in those discussions at different measures. During those early days, the Chief Minister and I were in daily contact, sometimes more often than once, sometimes frequently, especially during the period between mid-March and the end of April, and leading up to the publication of the Unlock the Lock document. It was very, very frequent, I believe we have worked well. There have been testy moments that I've described, as been asked by journalists before in this a couple of times. I don't think it's helpful to describe what they were, but that has been a mark of the process that we have been engaged in. And I have to say this, because in the context of the Chief Minister's comments on the government of national unity that he would have considered, he did mention it at the time that we described, we had the session on the emergency budget, and indeed we had a discussion about the constitutional interpretation of the particular section of constitution and so on. But of course, we never reached the point where there was an offer inviting them to form part of the national unity government, and none had to be considered. If there had been an offer, it would have been first had to have been considered by a shadow cabinet, and then indeed the executive of the party. But of course, it was not necessary, and people will know that my reaction in those brief discussions that we had on the issue was simply, I hope that it is not necessary. Because indeed, it would have been a bad sign, not a bad sign in terms of whether we could work together, but a bad sign of where Gibraltar was, that we had actually had contemplated a government of national unity. And I'd like to take up also a comment that I read in the Chronicle this morning, where my friend Mr. Fanon was observed, or at least reported to have said on the reconvening of Parliament that the GOP and the government had had unity over the last few weeks. And I have to say, with all due respect to my good friend, he's wrong in that, because there's a big distinction between what I believe we have done over the last 80 days, which is the politics of cooperation, and the politics of unity. There's a big difference between a government of national unity, where you are accepting offer. First, the offer has to be tendered, then it has to be accepted, and then you, in effect, merge into the executive, and you accept the collective responsibility of that, because government. We have not done that. We have had the politics of cooperation and the public interest, always reserving the right to disagree, always reserving the right to disagree publicly. And the division, while we have been confronted, the divisions of course of the covenant. I may have attended, but the divisions themselves were not divisions on which I voted, because of course they are the divisions of the government, and we are not part of that government. That's not to say that I disagreed. Indeed, there were a lot of those decisions because I agreed. I entirely agreed on behalf of myself and indeed my colleagues with many of those decisions that were taken, especially in relation to the social lockdown and the commercial lockdown. They were absolutely necessary, I've said so publicly. But there is a distinction to be made between what we did, which is the politics of cooperation, the public interest, and indeed the government and national unity. And it's important that people understand that. In the context of that, of course, I do want to also say that I acknowledge, that in the same way as he has done, I acknowledge the attitude of the Prime Minister in first handling that invitation to work with the opposition, and indeed his attitude throughout, even at the most testy moment. I think we have found a way to at least diffuse things. When we have disagreed on a number of issues, but we have often demonstrated that there has been a cooperative stance, and I acknowledge that his cooperative stance in providing information, submitting to that process, and indeed receptiveness to the ideas that we have given him as opposition. Because I also understand that they are the government. They've been elected not that long ago, as the government has just come out of an electoral process. It was for him to make the first move, and I acknowledge that he did that, and indeed the efforts of other ministers in liaising with us and providing information openly and positively engaging with us when we agreed and when we didn't agree. I also want to thank frontline staff, and I've done so on a number of occasions. I think it's important that this House recognises that, formally on the record, our thanks to essential workers and public servants, and indeed, above all, people who were so disciplined. But I will say this, and I think it's important for us to do that. This is only the first phase. We have done very well. It's important not to plant victory, if I can paraphrase a Spanish saying, because we are not there yet. Indeed, proof of it is that we have social distancing measures in Parliament today. This is not the backbench as I would have imagined it, Mr. Speaker. I would have preferred different backbenches. I certainly don't envision any of my colleagues that are sit behind me on the right benches. Perhaps that's for the future. We will have better parliamentary reform. I absolutely want to in the front page. But, Mr. Speaker, but I think proof of it is that is where we are as a community, and it's important for us to be consistent social messaging. And indeed, if I may say on an aside, and the tone has been positive, and I'm going to say this is as positive a state as possible for the Chief Minister, I did think it's important that messaging is consistent, and then I feel it to you, so that people are aware of what the position is and that there is no confusion. And I have to say, I did think that whoever drafted the press release yesterday, where there is a particular line in the Diamond press release that says that it is irresponsible to win the league before the Beijing season, I think probably overstepped that mark, I have to say. Because at the end of the day, the unlock the rock document does say that you can win the league for 13 points. The early messaging has said that. I just tell the Chief Minister a little story. I think that people might have been a bit baffled actually by that line. I went for a walk to Sunday Bay on Saturday, and I zealously wanted to be very careful that I stuck to the public health advice, so I actually hung myself on the stopwatch. I got engaged into a conversation with someone when I was on the stand, and it took so long that by that time I looked at my watch, I was in 27 minutes, I hadn't had time to even take my shoes off. So I then left the beach in accordance with the public health advice, but I have to say to him that there was at least one member of the government there in his court, waving in the sea, and so I think it's important that we all follow that we can do. You know, the advice is taken here, it's okay. But we can say it's responsible because that confuses people. And I say it in the best spirit possible to the honourable member. I do agree, as the honourable member says, that we are at a sensitive moment. Because looking forward, and indeed the work that we have done with my honourable colleague Mr. Clinton, and indeed the government, the economic management of this is going to be as treacherous as the public sector management. And certainly we are alive to that. It is going to be compounded probably by Brexit. That hasn't gone away, and that is always going to be there. The revenue is going to be dented. Consumer confidence globally has been dented, and so will the market. And businesses will need more help, and I think we both agree that going forward, when the beat may be finished on the 30th of June, we will need to revise and think about how we do that. And indeed, proportionality of measures will need to be kept in active review depending on where we are as a community in the management of the public health crisis. And all of that is acknowledged. In the same way as the Chief Minister has reflected on that moment of the possibility of national unity because of where we were in mid-March, I also want to add these reflections, if I may, on that. Because, and it struck me yesterday because I was watching the coverage on Telegram about the Spanish session in Parliament yesterday, where it was either accusations that people were almost quasi-terrorist or undermining democracy or calling for insurgents. The vitriol was such that I just don't know. I sometimes watch that and I think, really, is that the best for your particular country? And of course, I make no comments. And people in Spain, in the political panorama, it is that people need to make their own decisions, and I don't. And I'm not pretending for a moment of giving lessons to people as to how they should behave. But I will say this, that in comparison with that, over the last 80 days, I believe we have been able to work together in this space in a way that other countries have not, and I think that has been important, and I hope that the verdict of history is favourable to us being so different to how perhaps other countries have conducted a process. You know, when people say to me, well, why haven't you started doing the research and asked for information and published and so on? And invariably, it's because the government has provided the information when we have asked, or accepted our ideas, or indeed accepted our comments on matters on which we have been consulted. And people need to understand that, and people also need to understand that anyone who knows me, or indeed my colleagues, would be surprised to think that we are going to submissively participate in a process as lambs. Now, I think that we all know each other well enough to understand that when we agree, we do so. But when we disagree, we are not afraid of things, so we know each other well enough. And I think, at the end of the day, the whole point of the political cooperation is not just to sit there like silent lemmings, but to actually participate in a proactive and vigorous way. And yes, it's no different to being in council of ministers. The idea that when I was
in government, or indeed one of my colleagues who were served in government, sat as one in the GOP cabinet, that really is not to understand how the political process works. There are some people who have made observations that, about what this has meant for politics. But, you know, I have to say that those who say that democracy was impoverished by these events, in my view, underplay both the magnitude of the threat that we were in and do not understand the role of a responsible opposition. Because a responsible opposition has to make a judgment. A responsible opposition has to understand what is in the interest of the community. A responsible opposition understands that politics is not about being at loggerheads for the sake of being at loggerheads. Politics is about outcomes. Politics is about ensuring that our people do the best possible, that we save lives. And if the invitation is out there for us to work together at a critical time in this history, in the history of our nation, for us to save lives, taking the alternative of the Bastille of Allah would have been not only callous, but a mistake that would never have been forgiven in my view by this community. And she must be forgiven. And so when people say, where is the opposition? I say, doing its job. Doing the job it was elected to do, which is to make a judgment. Make a judgment. Make a judgment and decide when it is in the public interest to work together, because there are issues like that. We can fight about traffic. We can fight about parking fees. We're going to criticize the opposition, the government. We're going to criticize the government on a number of issues going forward. But there are issues as well where, in the public interest, it is important to work together. And I have said that before, and I appreciate that some people might not have believed me, because it was never put to the test. But now it has been put to the test. So I hope now that people understand that when the GOP opposition that I lead says that we are willing to work together with the government on issues of public interest, if we make that judgment, we will do so in a serious way. That does not mean that we are becoming the government, because we are not. We are going to retain our role as opposition. We are going to be robust and formidable. We are going to test those ideas. We are going to provide our own input. And at the end of the day, we hope that that delivers better outcomes to people. Because otherwise, people who criticize that, for us doing that, confuse the process with the outcome. As if it were better just to be a loggerhead, to have the destructive negativity just for the sake of it. Mr. Speaker, in this crisis, we all had a brother, or a sister, or a parent, or a daughter, or a son that could have been affected by COVID. When we met in mid-March, and we were faced with that reality, people were losing their lives in droves in every single country of the world. Countries that have the most sophisticated medical services around. It was impossible to believe that we were going to back the statistical trend. And yet, here we are. And so, of course, when we make the judgment of whether we cooperate or not, we make the judgment in the circumstances that we find ourselves in mid-March. It's important always never to leave us through battle, as I say often and ask for people to listen to me. And the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister, as a historian, knows that that is the first thing we were taught in our history, A-level, and university. I believe that the vast majority of people welcome that we work together in the interest of this community, and we will go back to normal politics soon enough. Indeed, we are already doing so, because the level of engagement between the government and the opposition has lessened significantly from the beginning of May till now. and that is understandable and normal. We all want to go back to normality. Otherwise, we have to make that offer to join his cabinet that I would have to decline because the circumstances don't warrant it. I treasure my role and privilege as leader of the opposition for the time being. Yes, until the next election, when I hope to replace the honourable member. Mr. Speaker, I agree with the Chief Minister that there is opportunity going forward, and indeed there are still big issues on the horizon. The fact that we disagree on things is not a good reason for lack of engagement. Indeed, it is probably the best reason for engagement, because if we agreed with everything that the government did, then there would be no reason to engage with us, because we have no value. The importance about adding value is that we actually believe different things and see things differently and may have different perspectives on things. We may agree on certain things, but we also have different perspectives. And so, yes, I do agree. It is an opportunity going forward, and it is for us in this house to show that leadership and recoil from populism. And there is an opportunity for a new radicalism as long as it's done properly. A new radicalism that can be transformative. There is that opportunity. But there's nothing to be afraid of that. I also want to thank my colleagues in this federal house for the work that they have done in the last couple of months, in particular Daniel Heaton, of course, and civil contingency, my friend Elliot Phillips on health and environment matters, Dane Gatina on financial services, port and shipping issues, Edwin Reyes on educational matters, which we have discussed very closely because it is such an important aspect of the unlock process, as it was of the lock process, and in particular, of course, Roy Clinton, who has been by my side in the discussion always on public finances, as indeed he is our guru on that side of things. Mr. Speaker, we emerge from the first phase, and it is important to do a balance sheet. And in that balance sheet, I have made my comments of where we are. I think we should be cautious as we go forward, learn the lessons, and stay vigilant. There is much to do. Indeed, what concerns me particularly, as I have shared with the Chief Minister, is the period of the late summer, when after borders may open, there may be transmission of further cases. That did not scare us, because of course more human interactivity will do that. But the rise of cases needs to be closely monitored, and it does concern me about where we will find ourselves in late summer or early September. So we all need to be vigilant. That's the mission. Cautious, vigilant, adhere to the social distancing guidelines and the public health advice. Let us restore freedom in a measured, responsible, and careful way, because we all want that to happen. Let the poorest community survive in a sustainable, environmental, and economic way, because there is much to be done in the second phase.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. It is with the greatest sense of gratitude and relief that I stand here today, wanting to thank everyone in our government and in the front line, the health service in particular, and others in all the essential services, and those across our community for their integral part in preventing what could have been a very disastrous first wave during this ongoing pandemic. In few places across the world have we seen prepared empty field hospitals and a stock of unused ventilators because there was no practical crisis, despite reasoned expectations via modelling carried out by trained public health experts. This is certainly something to be proud of and something which is a clear indication that we have done a lot of things right. I do, however, emphasize ongoing pandemic because our work is still far from done, and I urge every member of our community to take heed of the necessary actions and precautions to ensure our well-being. My plea is to continue to listen, to comply with the much-needed recommendations that will allow us to safely navigate through these difficult times. However, Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, this also leaves me somewhat puzzled as to why I stand here today having to remind us about the role and the significance of the entire opposition, and not just one part of it, in an effective parliamentary democracy. A compliant community also needs a representation and a voice. A crisis such as this pandemic calls for heightened awareness, maximum representation and scrutiny to ensure the common good. My party suffered as a consequence being left out of many first-party briefings and meetings between the government and the opposition. The 20+% of the electorate that entrusted me and my party to defend their interests was left banished from the discussions on the management of the pandemic, a move that sadly, or maybe even conveniently, was never protested by the official leader of the opposition. All the while, government professing the importance of not playing party politics. This does not reflect a truly strong, constructive, and representative parliament. We were given a diluted democratic voice during the crisis, but we were not silenced as a watchdog of public interest. Our loyalty and sight firmly set on the common good constructively, we decided to make our voices heard loud and clear. We voted in favor of granting government all the extra powers it asked for, but being left out of key discussions did not mean we would stop doing what we felt our community needed. We voiced our concerns, which demanded stricter and earlier social distancing measures, the closure of schools, more robust and inclusive economic support measures, something which should have been brought to the table by us much earlier on. We also insisted on more and better use of PPE and on the implementation of better testing protocols. Listening and speaking to our constituents, despite not being allowed to bring their concerns to the table, felt wholly undemocratic. Nevertheless, Mr. Speaker, we were ahead of the curve at every juncture, pushing for measures that we, as well as most other nations, have eventually implemented. Our attitude towards the handling of the pandemic has been consistently one of proactive and constructive criticism, pushing government to do more and to do better. And we believe that we have made a humble yet meaningful contribution to the success we have enjoyed thus far. Mr. Speaker, with this situation being far from over, in epidemiological terms, strict lockdowns, despite being costly and traumatic, are easy to implement. There are also tried and tested ways to stop the spread of the disease. The real challenges begin now, Mr. Speaker, as we unlock the work as per the government guidelines. We must engage with our electorate fully, addressing majority and minority concerns as efficiently as possible. Because it pains me to say this, Mr. Speaker, but the current unlocking strategy feels like it is beginning to fall apart. And it feels like it's beginning to fall apart for many reasons, but mainly for the ones we have already expressed publicly. That is, mixed messaging and lack of enforcement. The general attitude in town, Mr. Speaker, is that the pandemic is over, that the job is done, and that the risk is negligible. The use of face masks is derided and mocked. The 2 meter social distancing is flaunted by pretty much everyone, including many of our public workers and politicians, and there is simply very little fear for COVID-19. And I'm afraid we cannot blame the general population for this dangerous misconception. We have to blame ourselves because we as politicians need to lead by example. And the message failure that has led us to a situation where we no longer have any fear of this disease needs to be rectified. Because at present, we are unprepared to safely start living with a virus that is still deadly and is still among us. that if we look back to mid-March, first, we were on our way to herd immunity. COVID-19 was little more than a flu that was going to move through our community. We even celebrated that some healthcare workers were captured and thus developing a first line of defense. Then, as disaster struck in other countries and UK public health advice was tragically debunked, we moved to a strategy of suppression, urging people to stay at home and protect themselves as much as possible from catching the virus. But did we admit our early advice was wrong? Did we say openly that we had made a mistake or followed the wrong advice? That we didn't want the virus to go through the community at all anymore? No, we did not, Mr. Speaker. We pretended mitigation and suppression were one and the same thing, and many people are still caught up in that confusion. As for social distancing, Mr. Speaker, we advise, but we do not enforce. We do not fine or demand adherence to norms. We tell people masks are good, but we ask them to use their common sense. We tell them to distance, but we take pictures in hospitals and indoor spaces surrounded by people without masks or without adequate distancing. Mr. Speaker, this is not how we unlock the rock safely. Right now, our concern as a party, and that of many of our constituents, is a lot of fear that we are heading straight into a second spike of cases, when we have done so well controlling the first wave. We need to end this ambiguity. The beach, for example, being a clear example which we raised last week and has now been echoed by the Leader of the Opposition. It is open and legal, but the government doesn't expect people to go. It is hot, there are people off work, there are students off school, but there are no security measures to protect people in an emergency. We need clear, strict, rules, coherent messages, and a degree of enforcement of the rules if we are to make a success of this most challenging phase of the pandemic. Mr. Speaker, I carry the suggestions and concerns of our civil society and community to this Parliament, and I invite government to engage with me whenever they decide to acknowledge that reality. The opposition voice is here to echo the voice of the people in a society which truly moves us to act inclusively and effectively. We want to do the right thing for Gibraltar with coherence and conviction. I thank again the government for its efforts and success so far and remind them that I stand available to roll my sleeves whenever called for in order to help our community in any way I can to get through the crisis. Mr. Speaker, on a separate note, it is regretful to have understood, to have noted that we haven't actually paid a tribute to the late Frank Pellegrini by a minute's silence or some kind of words for a man who was a minister for many years, as we have done with many others. We always do it at the beginning of every session. I'm letting you know. The minister behind is mocking me with gesticulation. I don't know, I will not in a nursery, we're in Parliament. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, thank you.
Following on from the statement made by my honourable friend, the Chief Minister, I welcome the opportunity to make a number of points for the purposes of handstand. Just as last 2 months ago, on the 25th of March, we then debated and approved an appropriation bill, and we voted to extend the financial year. Members agreed to take those extraordinary measures in the face of an abnormal situation. We did so in a calm, rational, and in a logical manner, and in a display of political unity. And I want to acknowledge the input from the members opposite, in particular from the Leader of the Opposition. To the players have been ousted in the face of unity before. This is not the first time. Also, it should not be relaxed. Once more, we have stood shoulder to shoulder against an external threat. An unusual threat, nonetheless, it must be said. A virus. A peril that you cannot see coming. In fact, you cannot see it at all. This cargo virus has posed them to target our elderly and attack our vulnerable. It represents a threat to life itself. A simple look around the planet today will confirm this. Nearly 5.5 million people have now been infected all over the world. Sadly, some 350,000 have lost their lives. And this is so much more than simple statistics. The numbers personify over 350,000 souls, real people, their pain and suffering, grieving families, lives stolen, and overwhelmed health services all over the planet. Thankfully, the water has been spared so far. But we're seeing how both the UK and Spain have been hit by COVID-19. The UK reported its first confirmed case in York on the 31st of January. Spain did so too in the Canary Islands on the same day. And to speak out the whole of January now seems a lifetime away. So much has happened since then. The virus now claimed over 37,000 lives in the United Kingdom and over 29,000 in Spain next year. We had, as often has been said, our first confirmed case here on the 3rd of March. When this house sat 17 days later, on the 20th of March, the danger we faced was a very real one. On that 20th of March, we've also had carried out 146 tests. We had 10 confirmed cases, 8 of whom were still active. 26 people went into self-isolation on that day, and 300 symptomatic people self-isolated that very week. As the Chief Minister has said, the advice to the government is blunt and direct. Thousands of people would be infected. Hundreds here could lose their lives. 1,500 could require hospitalization. And the risk of death was up to 3.4%. Mr. Speaker, this was a particularly difficult time for all of us. It was hard. A long, dark shadow descended over our daily existence. And we looked in horror at what was happening elsewhere, in China and in Italy in particular. We produced the modeling. We drew on the experience of other countries, limited experience at that time. And importantly, we prepared. In those terrible moments, the key to containing the pandemic was precaution. On the 4th of March, advice was issued to avoid large social gatherings. On the 5th of March, many public events were postponed or cancelled. On the 10th of March, the RUC driving test facility was given the go-ahead. On the 11th of March, the elderly and the vulnerable were warned stay at home. Further action followed. On the 14th of March, the closure of restaurants was announced. On the 15th of March, the bus service was suspended. Public councils were closed. On the 16th of March, the over 70s were confined by law. School children stayed at home. 20 days of escalating action culminated on the 24th of March when Gibraltar was shut down. The aim then was to keep people away from each other and in this way control the spread of the virus to ensure that the UK would be able to cope. Mr. Speaker, this time the enemy of our gates did not face us with spears or arrows or cannonballs. We faced a new and invisible menace, but our objective and our tactics were tried and tested. We shut our doors. We bolted the gates. We raised the drawbridge and removed our people from the path of danger. We spread the land in front of the virus. And behind those walls, we armed ourselves with it. Our weapons, not guns and mortars, not fireships and artillery, but preparation and organization. More ward beds were provided at St. Bernard's. A COVID ward was set up specifically. A COVID ICU also. A 500% increase in ICU beds. More ventilators. given us as PPE, the God of Methodists in the United Kingdom, a new field hospital to set up within days, and a call for volunteers was issued on the 15th of March. Over 1,100 people answered the call to arms. It is important to pay tribute to them all, because nobody quite knew what they were letting themselves in for at that time. And we also need to pay tribute to our health service, to the public health team, to our emergency services, to our essential services, to the civil service and the public sector, to the private sector, and to the people of Gibraltar as a whole. They were all our first line of defense, and their actions determined what would happen next. They go to the serious health hazard of our lifetime. Because the truth, Mr. Speaker, is that for just over a century, the world has not seen a global pandemic quite like this one. Connecting today with the so-called Spanish flu of 1918, which was arguably even worse than COVID-19. In terms of the estimated number infected, then 500 million people, the estimated number of deaths, 550 million, and the demographic that was most at risk, then those under 5, those between 20 and 40, and the elderly. So two factors at the time of the Spanish flu came in two waves, both here and worldwide. The first wave reached Gibraltar in May 1918. 600 cases were reported, and 21 people passed away. The second came in December 1918. There were then 3,000 cases and 111 fatalities. This second wave, locally and globally, was more lethal than the first. Nobody knows how this existing pandemic will evolve. What we do know is that we won the first battle in the war, and that in the event of a second battle against the virus, Gibraltar is now better prepared than ever before. Mr. Speaker, all over the world, COVID-19 has gone on a merciless rampage against the elderly. It has decimated care homes. It has destroyed the lives of the frail and added to the suffering of the vulnerable. We have seen that tragedy play out on our television screens. I have no doubt that the action taken in Gibraltar, the early action taken in Gibraltar, has saved lives. Many senior citizens here went into voluntary confinement. Measures were put in place at elderly residential services and strict controls at government sheltered accommodations. This has worked so far. The last figures I saw showed that only 9 over 70 contracted COVID-19 in Gibraltar. And they put up a fight and they sent the virus packing. We would expect nothing less from that generation, Mr. Speaker, and I want to praise them. 8 years ago last week, on the 22nd of May, many of them set sail across the Strait to St. Morocco. They did so in a process of wartime evacuation and re-evacuation that did not come to an end until 1951. And they faced the horrors of war in London. They braved the U-boat as they crossed the Atlantic westward, Jamaica and southwards to Madeira. They stood up through bitter winters in bare metal huts in Northern Ireland. Decades later, they were the backbone of our resistance to General Franco. They endured the hardship of a closed border and the years of siege that followed. And they did so on a point of principle. That golden generation, as the Chief Minister has described them, set an example to us all. They made a sacrifice for the common good, over and over again. At this time, they were asked to make yet another sacrifice, and again, they were not found wanting. Mr. Speaker, the government paid tribute to them. Because I, the 17th, were under advice to self-isolate before anyone else. The restrictions on them, first advisory and then mandatory, had lasted for longer than those on anyone else. All this time, they've been cut off from children, grandchildren, friends, and family. Some of them alone at home. I know that new technology has helped. Virtual groups have connected together. Support mechanisms have been set up. Food delivery, collection of prescriptions, and medication. All this has helped too. Mr. Speaker, that working structure was very ably strung together by my colleague, the Minister for Civil Contingency, Samantha Macamento, and the Civil Contingency Coordinator, Ivor Lopez. They have had every single detail at the fingertips and worked in every solution to every problem to find a solution. We also highlight the work of my colleague, the Minister for Public Health, John Cordes, and the Minister for Health, Rosa Vang. Every single member of the team has been closely involved, as the Chief Minister has said. To Deborah Summer, Albert Isola, and Vito Dianami helped to serve the transition to a wartime economy. And they will now be into the transition on the way back from that. Together with Gilbert Lehuzi, who has successfully handled our schools at the same time. And Stephen Nyers, who led the redeployment of the teams of the QSLA and housing, including the protection of our pensioner flats. All red from the front, by my own friend, the Chief Minister, who has not stress of taking difficult decisions and doing what needed to be done. That is what leadership is all about, Mr. Speaker. And that is why we have a good story to tell today. But getting there has not been painless. Some messages have been difficult. They have been hard to receive and equally hard to deliver. Tough decisions have needed to be taken and then communicated, both the good and the bad. We have acted on medical and public health advice. We have followed the experts. Mr. Speaker, in today's world, none of this is easy. Because everyone considers himself to be an expert on everything. And everyone has an opinion about everything. True, and this is healthy. But this often generates misinformation. And this misinformation often leads to confusion. This can be unhelpful at a time of a public health emergency and at a time of a global pandemic. The government continues to urge citizens to listen to official expert advice and to ignore everything else. It is that information has flowed from day one in a manner that is unprecedented, both in the detail and in the volume. A flash has been the daily press conference at 4 p.m. We have posted some 60 of these and reached the homes of thousands of our people directly. The vast majority have acted on what they heard. We have disseminated statistics, given advice, explained the law, and provided up-to-the-minute details about every aspect of the pandemic. Our small set of his team have risen to the challenge too. They have outdone themselves. And the government is very grateful for that. Since the 1st of March, the telephone has sent the set of data directly to thousands of mobile phones. The government has placed ministers and officials in front of the press and of the public. And their positions have been involved, briefed, and consulted. They too have had the opportunity to meet with our experts and to question them. My honourable friend, the Chief Minister, has said that he won the first round against COVID-19. And this is true. We have also said that the war is not over. Last week, the World Health Organization reported the biggest daily increase in infections yet, 106,000 cases in 24 hours. At the same time, the director of the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control has warned Europe to brace for a second wave. The question, she said, is when and how big. Therefore, when one block to water, it becomes all the more important to follow the rules, so that we can arrive to as near normality as possible. Because none of us want the pandemic to pick up again. Mr. Speaker, of course, there is life after COVID-19, but this life may be a very different one to the one we knew before. In a sense, we now move into a new world, a world that contains numerous unknown, possibly a world with less human contact, certainly a world people who need to adapt to what they call the new normal. And we all know what the new normal will be. Social distancing, contact tracing, aggressive testing, self-isolation, quarantine, and face masks. EasyJet announced this week that passengers will be required to wear face masks from the moment they step into an air terminal, throughout the flight, and until they exit at their destination terminal. We need to face that new challenge with common sense, with social responsibility, with discipline, and with an understanding of our civic duty. If an element of work, if we all work together, that is a new reality we must come to terms with. The House knows the importance of testing as we move forward. Iceland has been held out to the world as a model for COVID-19 testing. They have conducted more tests per million inhabitants than any other country, and often top the global ranking. Over this country, holiday weekend, for the first time, Gibraltar overtook Iceland and became first in the world, the global leader in testing. This is much about our determination and our resolve in the fight. It also is much about our organization. In fact, the number of tests done so far, which is over 7,000 today, represents some 21% of our population. Moving on, Mr. Speaker, the pandemic has taught the planet a valuable lesson in many ways and in many different areas. The recent lockdown has cleaned up the air, reduced the levels of noise. You could hear birds chirping through open windows. The canals of Venice have left their murkiness. Wildlife has now appeared in new localities. Marine life has flourished. The environment has become the clear winner. But this has also been a time to reflect deeply, to consider how we can best consolidate those green gains, to pause and to ponder, away from the daily challenges and the pressures of life. It has been a time to better understand the things we value most, to reassess what we once took for granted. Because the pandemic has opened our eyes, we have the family spending time together, walking, cycling, or jogging, parents joking with the children keeping in touch with their elderly relatives, neighbors taking care of each other, making sure that the elderly and the vulnerable are keeping safe. These retreats we have always enjoyed as a community, but we were losing them. Sadly, they have long disappeared from many other countries. So we need to step in the moment, in order to make sense of where we are, in order to cherish those values and treasure them. We see that these past months have taught us many lessons as a people, much more than about complex medical questions, much more than about public health pandemics. A sense of community, a sense of fellowship, a sense of purpose, a sense of individual action for the common good, and a sense of devotion as our family, which is now stronger than ever. We have come together in the fight against COVID-19. That fight is not yet over. We have already learned profound lessons about who we are. Thank you.
Thank all honourable members who have contributed to the debate for their words. They in particular can I start by thanking the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister for his very kind words and again for his remarkable and effective support to me throughout this period. But Speaker, during the course of my initial address, I omitted to highlight one aspect of the response that Gibraltar has seen, I think, and all of us have appreciated and have at different times praised, and that's the work that has been done in one particular division of the Gibraltar Health Authority, elderly residential services, Mr. Speaker, where we had a concern from the very beginning that if the virus were to get in, either with a relative visiting a resident or a member of the staff that might be asymptomatic, there would be a great difficulty for the whole community if the virus was spread amongst the residents. And the work that has been done there by everyone who works in the OS and has understood the need to be repeatedly tested, to wear PPE, led by Antonio Marino and Susan Vallejo, has been absolutely remarkable, and we do owe them a huge sense of gratitude. And I don't underestimate the people, the sacrifice that has been made by the relatives of those who are resident in ERS facilities who are not been able to visit their relatives. We're slowly trying to lock that in some way. The generosity of those who wanted to assist by donating technology that has been used for people to be able to receive their relatives. This is a part of the sacrifice that has been undertaken by the community, the work that has been undertaken by members of the community, that I do want to specifically highlight, because this is a key area of concern for all of us. Mr. Speaker, the prevalence of the infection in our community today, which will now be going out in the text messages, which the telecom will continue to send, is of 11 cases of COVID, 3 of them local residents, and 6 of them cross-country residents. I do want to make the point, Mr. Speaker, as honourable members who have contributed to talk about the pandemic not being over, that is, of course, exactly the situation that we are in, and we have to be particularly careful as we go forward. We cannot allow complacency to step in. And I do want to highlight, Mr. Speaker, that those that we are identifying as active cases are being identified remarkably in the frontline random public screen, not in the symptomatic testing. So a lot of people turning up with COVID-like symptoms are being tested and they don't have COVID. Some people are walking around and are being randomly tested, and that's where we're finding COVID. And it's important to speak of it, that be understood, that a lot of people who have the symptoms are suffering potentially from another strain of coronavirus, which we now know is a technical term for a form of flu, or indeed from allergies, which are also prevalent in the period. They don't have COVID, and yes, we're finding COVID in people with absolutely no symptoms. So this has not gone away. And you have to be careful, not just to shield yourself from someone who is coughing, or who is sneezing, or who might appear ill. Actually, the prevalence of the infection in our community now seems to be in those who have none of those symptoms. And particularly the reason that we're reporting where people are resident now is so that we understand, and this is a key factor as well, whether we are having community transmission or not. And as we move to the stage of contact tracing, and again, I don't want to preempt questions on the other paper, and talk about the detail of contact tracing and that fact we'll talk about in the context of the question time, it is important that we understand how the limits of contact tracing will operate once we've got people who are from beyond our shores. And the context of the public health has established the public health authority in Spain to cooperate with them so that they can do contact tracing also in Spain on that basis. Mr. Speaker, I obviously thank the Honourable Leader of the Opposition for his words this morning about the cooperation with the government and the fact that whatever we may say, of course, the judgment of history is not one that we can deliver today. It will be delivered by history, that is to say, by future generations. I mean, as we often quote that we can't read history backwards, I often quote that it's going to judge us, at least on this side of the House, well, because it's going to be written by the Deputy Chief Minister. Now that there is another historian in our midst, there might be two versions of that history. I hope that in respect of this part of the political history of Gibraltar, the history he might write and the history of the Deputy Chief Minister might write might be a little like a Venn diagram, and they might on this at least be at one, although for all I know, they could be at one in much more than just this part of our history. Because the other gentleman referred us to the numbers of those who have passed away. He knows that in one of our press conferences, I did that also because I'm remarkably struck by the size of the numbers. And this is one of the things that we must bear in mind. matter. In Italy, the number of people who died equates to the whole of the population of Gibraltar. In Spain, the number of people who died equates to all of the adult population of Gibraltar. In the United Kingdom, the country that we have the closest vicinity, the number cannot exceed the population of Gibraltar. And in the United States, the United States has now gone into seven figures in terms of the deceased, and those are really quite remarkable. And you can see, I was struck by a front cover of the New York Times that published the names of 1,000 American people. And actually printed a line, not just with their names and their ages, but a line with what they were known for by their families. You can demonstrate that these are statistics to a very great extent in the context of calculating what's going on with the virus. But each one of them is alive. Each one of them is alive. And I was struck by the way that the Honourable the Leader of the House, or also the Leader of the Opposition, referred to everybody being father or son or sister or daughter. I had made exactly that reference myself in a press conference. But it is particularly important that we never forget that it isn't just potentially a relative, it's potentially each of us. And that's the best way that we can bring the right attitude going forward as we move away from the initial period of what you might call the fear, is the ability to understand that each of us has to protect our family and ourselves from the things that would expose ourselves and each of our family units to the virus. If we all do that, then, Speaker, we are more likely to help the spread of the virus too. And if we all follow the rules, we're all more likely to ensure that there's no spread of the virus. And I come to some of the things that one of the ladies said about following the rules in a moment, but I think this is a key and important point. And so, Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman referred to the issue of messaging, which I will come to, and when I address the issue of the details that we were dealing with. But I think the best message is that we can each send out is a message of personal responsibility to follow what we understand the rules and to understand what the rules are. Not simply to fall into the shorthand of what the rules are, but to understand what the rules are. And I'll say a little more about that than I deal with some of the things. Some of the extraordinary things that the Honourable Lady has said. Mr. Speaker, in the way that the Honourable Gentleman responded when I called him and referred to the fact that that it was about 10 days after the investigation that he'd seen, when I showed him the signs of what we were doing. So I detected a man, because he had been Minister for Health, and understood the limits of what the health authority can do and the ability that the health authority had to surge and do more than it usually does, but also with a limit. And Mr. Speaker, you talked about the dark storms that we have had to grapple with. And my concern then, Mr. Speaker, when I spoke to him, and the concern that the whole Cabinet had shared and reflected on greatly, was that there was the possibility for great civil distress about the issue. And again, reflecting on numbers, which the gentleman gave, and I discussed them in the past. If you talk about 1,000 people dying in the context of the data, you're touching every family. If you get to 3,000 people potentially dying over that period of the virus, a lot of them dying in a short period, whether that turned out to be right or it turned out to be wrong, whether the calculations eventually were better understood in the context of different models, that's what you're supposed to. You see that that is more than just every family being by the way. That is worse than any war we have to do. And that can lead not just to great grief, but to great civil distress that can lead to a very, as I said it before, very dystopian probability. And we have avoided all of that. And faced with those remarkable potential consequences, I thought it was clear to both of our teams, and I think it's clear, it was clear to both of us that we had to work together. The other thing is the fact that we've been in almost daily contact for a period, in almost daily contact as we haven't been for 30 years. very frequent, and that we work well together with such key moments. But of course, there's bigger. There are such key moments in every relationship, and because of the relationship, there are such key moments. I think what we did was a hard thing to do. Because if the Speaker looks like the Honourable Gentleman also reflected, we are 6 months out from the general election. 7 months out from the general election. There are 10 members of this House here and 7 there. The easy thing is to say, well, look, if you don't want an emergency budget, we'll have one. 10 to 7. If you don't want regulations, we have them. 10 to 7, or sign a woman's behind. The hardest thing to do is to get through those sexy moments, and sometimes it's incumbent on us lawyers to work around the stones of the accountants throw in our way, or vice versa. But that was a hard thing to do, and we have achieved it. And it is right that we should have worked harder to achieve that in this moment. And it is right that we should take something from it, hoping to take something from it, because there will be things in the future where the consequences are not as dramatic, but where we might work a little harder to try and find consensus, because it will be in the interest of the community as a whole. And he's absolutely right, Mr. Speaker, that it would have been to cross a difficult Rubicon to get to the stage of a government of national unity. It would not have been something that either of us would have done lightly. It was right, however, that given the speed at which we were moving in the context of the difficulties that we were currently facing, that we should be prepared and lay all of the groundwork for those potential steps to have to be taken, if they have to. But it would have been a very bad sign indeed. It would have been a sign that we were moving in the direction of those casualties materializing. That's the distress potentially of being around the corner. And we have managed to work together without having to stress that Rubicon. It is the reason, Mr. Speaker, I'll just allow my first one moment of reflection, why we did not believe that it was right to accept the invitation to move to a government of national unity when that invitation was extended to us by the then leader of the opposition, now sitting to his left, the Honourable Mr. Speaker, at the time of voting, because we understood that there was a potential for this to do well, despite Brexit. And it would have been a very bad sign indeed if we had had a government of national unity then. But the need might be there again in the future. And if it is, not on COVID or anything else, if I am here and that need materializes, I will still extend the hand in the relevant circumstances. If I am not here, if I am there, or anywhere else, and it is ever extended to me, or I am asked by anyone whether it should be an invitation that should be accepted, in the right circumstances, the answer, in my view, is always yes, Mr. Speaker. And in that, Mr. Speaker, I join him in his gentle admonition of the Honourable Lady and any others who might think that cooperation is a weakness. In cooperation is an opportunity for communal success, for community support where necessary, and it is absolutely right to take that course where it is possible, Mr. Speaker. And the leadership of Mr. Osama, or Mr. Joe Osama, has always been based when he was the leader of the JPP, the leader of the coalition in particular, on doing the right thing for the vote. And if I can just, I don't seem to use this as an issue of difference between us, and I don't mean to go anywhere near scoring points. But on the issue of debt, for example, if you look at Joe Osama's position, whether he's in government or in opposition, in relation to debt and how debt should be approved, there was never a change in his mind simply because he changed position. On the issue of sovereignty, the key issue which concerns us all, and I will always remember, and was so impacted by Joe Osama's saying of Peter Kahwana in relation to the issue of joint sovereignty, although then there was no attendance of cabinet, no office, no union, or anything. Perhaps not necessary, because there the rival was not invisible and biological, there the rival was political, visible, and abundant. Let alone in Madrid. But Joe Osama's position was to say, look, before they get to him, the one Chief Minister, Peter Kavanagh,
they have to get through me. There is no need for us to pretend to disagree where we agree. There is very good reason for us to robustly challenge each other where we disagree. Because if we disagree genuinely, we disagree for good reason, and we want to make the point to the other that it is better to pursue this force than the other.
But it does not impoverish democracy to agree.
Indeed, Mr. Speaker, much of what we do goes by agreement. And too often in democracy, we are just analysing the 0.1% in which we disagree. And that's fair enough. Because if you want to get even that 0.1% right, but there is not an impoverishment of democracy there at all. That is the richness of the system that we run, where it is run by those who are able and prepared to work together when they have to. And they have the courage and the strength of character to take steps forward together when they have to. And the Speaker, it is indeed quite remarkable to see the layout of this race today. I consulted and had worked with Deputy Chief Minister the clock on setting out the central field a bit tight. I don't know whether it's me and my pandemic weight issues or whether it's just that it is a little tight. But I'm very relaxed about how we are sitting. We are all front centers, whether we're at the front or at the back here. And I have no concern, Mr. Speaker, about the old Victorian adage that in a good sport of layout, the enemy is often behind one and not in front of one. But given that we're not going to indulge in any partisan exchanges, so I will leave it just like that. I think everyone gets my point. On the speaker, on the consistency of messaging, however, I have to say to both of the honourable members of the spoken that we do have to be really careful with something as apparently trivial as the beach. It's apparently trivial because we're talking about a moment ago the potential for mass casualties in our community, and now we're talking about going to the beach. But the beach is one of the areas in which we have given advice. Yes, ministers have gone to the beach, also strictly following advice to go for exercise, to go for 30 minutes. I don't want anybody to think otherwise. There is a possibility that the beaches may be closed. If people are not observing the rules for social distancing, if we then took the steps necessary to facilitate that the beaches should be open before the bathing season, and I remind all of the members that the Bowen government did not have lifeguards or services until the beginning of the bathing season, we brought that forward when we were in government. We've just for this year taken the posture they used to take. That's important. But we have to be very careful not to send mixed messages. And look, the Honourable Gentleman, perhaps a little more gently than the Honourable Lady, who I'll come to in a minute, used the beaches as an area of mixed messages. This is the key point. If you facilitate attendance at a place that you're saying you should not be going to come in the field, then you start to send the mixed message. And I just find it very difficult to understand how people should claim it here. If somebody is irresponsible enough to bathe whilst the red flag is flying, the government has a responsibility to have someone there to save them, despite the fact that the government has responsibly already told them that they shouldn't be bathing even if a potential danger to life. This is a key issue, because it goes to personal responsibility, it goes to common sense, and it goes to messaging. And I think both honourable members have not understood that there is that potential for the message to be mixed. I see suggestions that the government may somehow suggest that the lifeguards are designed to entice people to the beach. Nothing could be further from the truth. But if you provide a infrastructure for attendance at the beach, how do you at the same time say, legitimately, do not attend the beach unless you have to offer more than 30 minutes? So I think that is the difficulty. But Mr. Speaker, I think it is also true to say
Trump, Prime Minister Johnson, and President Sanders would be delighted to be having a debate about whether or not people should go to the beach or to be lifeguards and whether they were snapped from their speedos, Mr. Speaker, and not the debate that they're having. But not the debate that they're having, Mr. Speaker. So I think that has to be understood. And our message does not change. I mean, Mr. Speaker, I read recently that somebody thought that I was being irresponsible because we're sending the message to stay at home unless you're going to work, etc., etc. But I have cited to the top of the rock, except, of course, we've also said that people should exercise. And Mr. Speaker, I need exercise more than most, and I was only able to get to the top of the rock on the bicycle because it was electrically powered. Otherwise, they would have had to pick me up somewhere along the road. But you see, it is important to understand the detail of the rules before saying to people you must abide by the rules. Okay. So, we've been very clear. As long as you observe the rules of social distancing, you can be at the beach. If the beach gets too crowded, the rules are closed. Please, therefore, to avoid the beach getting crowded, be there for less than 30 minutes, give everybody a chance to be in or out. So, we need to put things into their proper context, and we need to understand the rules that are now in place. The gentleman and I, and members of the cabinet, have expressed concerns about civil liberties throughout the first period. I mean, there has not been here a government wanting to interfere with civil liberties. We have to remember that at the moment, our civil liberties are still impacted. I say that because they're impacted by my government and with my consent. It's not something I want to see continuing because we're restricting access to places and we're still restricting the key freedom of association, the right to gather with as many people as you like, wherever you like. We're still impacting that. And that can have the enforcement of demonstrations have not proceeded today when people want to demonstrate that their right to demonstrate and to manifest themselves against the government or in favour of the government, Mr. Speaker. And we need to understand that we are not completely yet out of the part of this process which is seeing restrictions and liberties. So people who are wanting to go to beaches, etc., people who want to comment about that need to understand that. The Honourable Gentleman said that he would look at any economic measures that he proposed to understand their proportionality and how they might affect business. He expects to be trying to consult with him and Ms. Clinton on the feedback from CELAC during the course of next week. There's a fair CELAC meeting at the end of this week. He then moved on to address the issue of as an example, the session in the Spanish Parliament yesterday. And I was equally struck, Mr. Speaker, by how the parliamentary debate has been infected in some jurisdictions, the political debate in some places, the presidential system that's not actually in a particular house of debate. But how vitriol has got worse in some places during this period rather than better. And how those who passed away as a result of COVID are being used in the political debate by one party against the other. I confess, Mr. Speaker, I am disgusted. And I watch that from the outside, whether I watch it in Spain or I watch it in other jurisdictions. It's not a comment on any particular parliament, but I am disgusted when I see it. And I am conscious, Mr. Speaker, when I feel that in particular in this context, and how people might look at us in some of the debates we've had in the past when we have allowed our personal objections to get the better of us. We are all human, after all, but I think it is an antidote to those moments when we see others go through the process that they're going through now. And I think sometimes the students have ground themselves to a halt, in effect, in terms of the work that needs to be done, which very often requires cross-party consensus to the vote that it is going to be enduring, and that is very worrying indeed, Mr. Speaker. Indeed, I might say that there are moments when this House, and may even have set an example for those beyond our shores, perhaps even to those who gave us our constitution. And that, Mr. Speaker, is a good thing, and as a reason for this community to rejoice, but too often the political process is the source of reason for people to regret. I think at the moment people might take a slightly different view, but that's not what I'm to say. The bigger, of course, that it is not necessary to start from the rooftop when we have disagreements, as Jane was going to say, and we have wanted to ensure that the process of working together has been successful. We have wanted to ensure that we have accepted views which honourable members have given us. We have not wanted to be difficult and political. We have wanted to be open and positive, and I know that they have too, in the way that they have approached it, and I think that is what has delivered the test. Perhaps, Speaker, that's why people should reflect the words or the nomenclature of the loyal opposition carries that reference to loyalty. It's loyalty, Mr. Speaker, to the process, to the people who elect them. So, we'll get the side of the city when we're elected for a purpose, and that's what a loyal opposition does. So, I think, Mr. Speaker, that you have to take in the zero of loud attitude, as you described it, as a callousness. And if it was sad, I think that the judgment of history would have been as negative on him and them as it will likely be on them and those that have. So it was also, in my view, Mr. Speaker, very few politics to have done what the Honourable Gentleman did and the Honourable Gentleman and worked with the government as they have. Can I simply just, therefore, keep them in the direction of what my own instinct is, and I don't often give political advice to my opponents, but I will just gently point them in the direction of what my own political instinct is, which is that people do want that courage and that bravery to continue from all of us. And so there are those things we critics of us in terms of parking fees and road closures. It's one attitude. People even also point out that you can talk about being committed to climate change as much as you like, but when the time comes for action, you're not ready to take the steps necessary to change behaviour, then it starts to build with people. But if one day you complain that we're going too fast, and the next you complain that we're not going slow enough, it starts to grate with people. And that there are some great things that we could do together, Mr. Speaker, on climate change, on roads, and on parking, but that the populist route is the route of saying, if the parking thing is put up by one penny, we're against it, we're with you, etc. Gentle suggestion that there is a different road that we could take, Mr. Speaker, that would be in the best long term interest of this community. Mr. Speaker, the other conversation will continue to provide input on matters as we were ready to take that advice, and of course we will be open to listen to input genuinely given. We have done a lot of that work now out of the public domain. That's where we will do most genuine work. I think I've also demonstrated to the Honourable Gentleman, as I have said before in this House, but no one has ever tested me on until now, that when an idea comes from the opposition, and if the government accepts it, we will not pretend it was a government idea. We will be open and frank about the fact that it was an opposition suggestion. And I've often had that dispute as to motions where our support is put, and I've always said, well, if you let it into your thinking before you put the motion, and you can then put the motion yourself and say it comes with government support. But otherwise, we will consider it to be just political posture. I think it's important just to reflect because we've had unnecessary kingdoms about that in the past. But I do hope the government has now demonstrated to them that we are fulsome in demonstrating that something has come from the opposition and is worth supporting when it does. And I hope that has in effect the way that they do things in a positive way of going forward. It was impossible, Mr. Speaker, to believe that we might start the policy for the trend. The trend internationally for casualties, and it is remarkable that we've got this far without any, and we hope and pray and continue to work to ensure that we will be able to continue to back the trend. It is also now impossible to believe. And that's why I made the reference to the partisan nomenclature of the party represented here in the speaker, that the Associated Liberals and the Greens could suck the trend of what's happened around the world, the political trend as well as the statistical trend. The rivalries have been long and intense, and yet we were able to do so. And that, Mr. Speaker, is definitely something worth remarking about the speaker. There is now less contact between us, Mr. Speaker. There may be more as we move towards the new financial measures, etc. But it is fairly natural. I mean, he's a busy lawyer, sometimes difficult to get hold of, more difficult to get hold of than the chief minister on occasion. So I don't think there's anything strange or wrong in that, but you should know, Mr. Speaker, that as things become more robust and as we continue to move back to normality, we will do everything we can to ensure that he continues in the role of leader of the opposition for many years to come, especially beyond the next general election. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady started by expressing some gratitude and relief, which I think is an emotion that most people would want to express. I express the gratitude of government to our frontline workers in the whole of the public sector, and those in the private sector have also continued operation. And relief, of course, is what we all feel. But the Honourable Lady is very particular. She said that she expressed her gratitude and relief to the government and to Sunlight Workers, therefore two separate entities, and to our trained public health experts. I thought it was a good of her to start that way and to express her views in that way. I don't think she would have found support outside of here for any expression of emotion other than that. But it was the beginning of a very mixed message, Mr. Speaker. In particular, for somebody who told us that one of the key potential areas of difficulty is mixed messaging, I think she incurred in mixed messaging herself. And that's what she was trying to do, was to say both things. The thing that she knows is right, which is that the frontline workers and the government and the same public health experts have done a remarkably good job. The results of which speak for themselves, so now, and especially hope and pray that we will continue to see those results, while at the same time trying to, as an apology for her role in the past, in the past 12 weeks, try and find a way of justifying the position that she's taking. So, I empathize with her. I mean, to an extent, the result of her electoral failure has come to roost in this period. There is an official opposition, there is a leader of the opposition, there are 7 seats on that side, 6 were taken by the GSD, only 1 was taken by her. So it's impossible, Mr. Speaker, for the government to be expected, and I won't talk about an amendment that she's on the order paper, but it's impossible for any government to be expected to engage with a whole opposition bench. And our constitutional system of government and parliament provides not a constitutional role of, but recognition by the speaker of, a leader of the opposition for a reason. And that is so that there is engagement between government and the leader of the House and Chief Minister and the representative of the majority of the opposition benches. That is what has come to pass in the past 12 weeks. She had no difficulty with those issues when she was a member of the official opposition. But Mr. Speaker, now she has a difficulty about which I thought she expressed in terms a little too sentient to be realistic. So, for example, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable has had a number of briefings. She might have wanted more, but she's had a number of private briefings. She's come to my office and met with the Minister of Public Health and the Director of Public Health. And with members of the opposition as well. And we should rather wait. We've met a number of occasions with the Chief of the Trust and his officials, and I do hope that we will continue to take those efforts. But the United Kingdom's strategy to release some of the restrictions there, Mr. Speaker, shared with the leader of the opposition in the United Kingdom half an hour before it was published. We had the Parliament and the opposition were working together. And all of them had embarrassingly early drafts, if I may put it that way, work which I would not usually have shared outside of a compound of my cabinet colleagues with notes and mistakes in it, which we were working through, the usual early draft of any document. We had it 3 hours before it was published, Mr. Speaker. So, crying for a lack of consultation and a lack of involvement, which is more than the involvement that the leaders of the opposition have in other parts of the world, even when they are members of a civic council, Mr. Speaker. Because therefore there is no democracy. Well, Mr. Speaker, there is a lot of democracy. The Honourable Lady got a percentage of votes in the last general election, and Honourable Members got a percentage of votes, and we got a percentage of votes. But we have not an electoral college system, we have a parliamentary system, a self-party vote system which produces a result, Mr. Speaker. And therefore, because we've got one seat, we've consulted in that context. But otherwise, the Honourable Lady ends up being like a failed presidential candidate who didn't get enough electoral college votes, but got more popular votes in the whole of the United States. Claiming that the founding fathers had set up a different constitution that might lead to different electoral results. That is not the case, Mr. Speaker. So, I didn't stand with her election, I didn't stand with them for election, I stood with my team. You stood with her team, others stood with another team, and this is the result of the general election. It happened. That is the reality. That is the reality. But if you don't want to say something really quite remarkable, which I cannot allow to pass without comment, which is that he was urging us to make more and better use of PPE, and it seems to be ahead of the curve at every juncture. If you have a sentence, Mr. Speaker, I think those words will stand out to you, whoever it is that reads it. I think that gently say to him, Mr. Speaker, that if you don't feel that that is the case, well, it's not the feeling that people had at the last general election, otherwise they would have put her on this side of the house, but on that side of the house. It's also not a feeling I respectfully tell her that I am left with in the context of my discussions with her in relation to this matter. And it doesn't fit well with the message that she started to deliver, which was to express gratitude and relief for the work, forget the government, Mr. Speaker, of us public health professionals who have done such a great job. So either she thinks that they've done such a great job, or she thinks that she was ahead of them at every juncture, and she should send them a note verbal once a week of what she thinks they should be advising us to do. I really don't think that this is a time for that sort of politics, and I don't think it would help her stature that she has taken that approach in the context of this debate, which I think is unfortunate. And I don't think that she has spent the past 12 weeks pushing the government to do more and better with a lot of the things that she said, which of course means that she is pushing all of us to do more and better when we're trying to work together. And I think it does deprecate the work that she does, Mr. Speaker, as a member of the Parliament, and she brings issues concerning their constituents, etc., that need attention, and that she tries to assist her with it. It does deprecate that work when she takes this sort of unfortunate and unnecessary attitude. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, it might be helpful to just look back and to see whether, in fact, we are all now doing the things that he said we should have done, and that is what has produced the positive results that we've seen reported in our community. I really don't think that anyone should make that claim. I certainly don't. I don't think I've done everything right at every turn, and I look back and I think this was exactly the right thing to do on the 28th of February, and exactly the right thing to do on the 10th of March. I more humbly look back at what we've done, and thank goodness that we seem to have got it right. The whole world, the whole world is seeing this virus develop. It's a new virus. We didn't understand it. The attitudes at a scientific level were changing. A scientific interpretation of what the virus did and who it did it to was changing. Well, Mr. Speaker, the other alternative is to take her at face value and say, look, at least one of us knew what was was happening. At least one of us understood the virus before all the rest of us. At least one of us knew what it was that we had to do. I commend her to send her services to the World Health Organization. Mr. Speaker, the unrest of Ross Document is not taken through. Far from it. It's a very good piece of work that I'm very proud that this government has produced. It's really the beginning of the work that we will do. There will be more parts, as I've indicated. Although we may not be working as close together, I hope that members of the regionally want to contribute to it. It's more of it will be economic now, and I will, of course, continue to ask that if they want an input, they should be able to have it, because it's a community document. To a very great extent, it will be part of the historical record of this pandemic, and it's important that we don't start to deprecate it. Simply because one part of the document might say, this happened in this phase, and it happened, and the phase starts on one date, and it happens on another date in that phase, it does not mean that the document is radically good. This is not a community that is failing to adhere to the rules that we are proposing. Far from it. The success, Mr. Speaker, that I have spoken about, is in great measure because the Gibraltarians and residents of Gibraltar, not always in Gibraltarians, but we have to recognize, have understood what they need to do as we slowly unlock. Yes, of course, some people have been desperate to get out. Yes, of course, some people have worked at different times to not stay at home despite that being the advice. We fully understand that. But people have, in very great measure, followed the advice. And the lack of enforcement is so very good. So, I don't know what it is that you want. Everyone likes that. And I'm not suggesting that they're all being taken to the beach. Far from it, I know which is a bad idea. Does anyone like God and you know, people to stay at the beach as long as they like? Or does anyone police officers with timers at the beach telling people that their 13 minutes are up? Because one moment he tells us that we need enforcement, and that's what the young officer rock says, and the next moment he tells us that we need like us. I really understand, Mr. Speaker, and no doubt perhaps later during the course of this session, the question time, she might be in some of her contributions, and to further clarify that. Yes, Mr. Speaker, there have been decisions taken in the United Kingdom and remarks here about herd immunity, about whether this is a flu, but what Mr. Speaker, whether the first line of defense in the GOJ and the National Health Service will benefit from those who have contracted the virus coming back because they'll have immunity, to a very great extent, that's still being talked about in the United Kingdom. But listen, public health advice has changed. Scientific advice has changed, scientific understanding. Does that mean that UK advice was debunked as the other way to say? Obviously, that's her interpretation. It's a matter for us. I think we work well with Public Health England, and in particular, I haven't mentioned him, but I should. Dr. Nicholas Jarrett at Hampshire Hospital is a consultant for the Gibraltar Advocate, working directly with Public Health England, with the support of Public Health England as well when it comes to swabs, particularly. We'll talk about swabs and reagents and answer some of the questions later. I don't see advice that even being debunked. I don't see that sort of populist description of what has happened as being relevant, and I really don't think that's what we need to be doing. And on the issue of masks and the advice, it's true that some countries have required masks to be worn in some areas. So Spain is requiring it in some respects, Germany is requiring it in some respects. The World Health Organization has taken a position. We've taken the position that the World Health Organization has taken. That means if you are inside and you cannot observe the rules of social distancing, 1 to 2 meters away from another person, and you're going to be there for more than 15 minutes, then you should be advised to wear a mask. And there are some circumstances and other circumstances that wear a mask may be advised. Please not within 1 to 3 meters of anyone in this house. For more than 15 meters, I think there's a limit, I think there's more space here. You choose to wear a mask. It's a matter entirely for her. Nobody prevents you from wearing. There's no rule that says you shall not wear a mask if you go to school. There is no requirement to wear a mask as long as you can observe those parameters. Now, I might wish to see everyone wear a red scarf, because that might make everyone look more social. Do you mean that we should, Mr. Speaker? It's a question of whether there is a public health advice there, and applying the precautionary principle, whether that is the right thing to do. that the advice that we have, this is not political decision making. This is the advice that we have. As you might say, months from now, that's easy point, Mr. Speaker. Right? Is that France should be won in the circumstances in which we said they should be won, not otherwise. Which is a time that's very difficult to persuade me. But we should do things which we are not advised to do by legislation. In other words, that the government should require a law, which is what to make compulsory means, function which it does not have public health advice is necessary on the basis of it is necessary for public health. Because the government should not otherwise be legislating. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I think you need to understand that the trigger to legislate has to be that the public health advice is there. Otherwise, there is no legitimacy to the legislation. Then he says, we have done so well in the first wave. So he starts with gratitude and relief, because he then criticizes everything that we've done in that process, talks about the bank advice, and then tells us that we've done very well in the context of the first wave. What we have done quite well in the context of the first wave is we went to call it a wave, we think it was more of a cluster. We mustn't get complacent, there's a long road still to go. There are great dangers in the way. The other gentleman raised the issue of the autumn, I agree with him, that is potentially a greatly dangerous period. The summer may be dangerous because of the advice that he may not deal with the virus as much as it might love it. But there is great danger in the way. But I just say to you, maybe as gently as I can, that her contribution has been very, very mixed in the way that it has tried to straddle both relief, success, gratitude, and support with the huge criticism, I was ahead of every juncture, the advice of the UK, and therefore the advice of the following is debunked, and you must make decisions in respect of after services. But I do think there is an element of confusion there, and our success so far, as we put it, Mr. Speaker, is not as a result of having followed her advice so far, though we want to think of it that way. But I am sure that there will be many who will want to agree, and some who she will persuade to agree if she decides that she wants to use this critical period in our political life as an anvil on which to hammer her partisan advantage and opportunity. Mr. Speaker, I don't think that anybody was mocking her, and this is not a mystery, it is a parliament. Never has it been more of a parliament than it is today. And Mr. Speaker, I am so sorry that she decided to take that attitude, but particularly if it comes from, and I'm not sure that she has really demonstrated that she is ready for leadership in this community, and I'm really sorry indeed. But in the context of this debate and in the context of this statement, that we have had to deal with answering points like that that you ended up making. Mr. Speaker, I have nothing else, but I'm happy to give an indication to the House before I sit down of what I expect today will be before anything else. If you've given the time, I would have thought that after anything else that needs to be said this morning, I would adjourn now for an hour or so, and then come back to lay on the table to take questions, to bring a resolution that I discussed with the leader of the resolution, and we may have a small amendment, and then take an ability to specify the urgent, which is the important to do, as a deference to the Honourable Lady, because I understand tomorrow is a good speech day. I will be hoping not to bring the House back tomorrow to finish all of that business today, and I would ask the Honourable Gentleman therefore and the Honourable Lady therefore just to bear in mind supplementaries in the Parliament have always been up to them and up to the Speaker. But if we can get through the questions quickly today, then that would help us to deal with all of the business today and in the future, we don't have to come back to more than a day. Thank you.
With the indulgence of the House, I'd like to say a few words on the first day of Parliament resumed its normal activities after the enforced break brought about by the COVID-19 health emergency. I'm addressing the House as a Speaker and also as an over 70-year-old member of this community who have been in lockdown for 10 weeks. I'm so grateful to everyone who has played a part in fighting this terrible threat to our lives. I'm so glad to be alive and back here to decide over this meeting of Parliament. There have, however, been many moments when I was very afraid. I thought I might contract the virus and die. This was not fun. I'm sure that many of our community would have had similar thoughts. Thankfully, so far, we have been well and have all pulled through and are now ready to resume our lives, albeit in a rather different world. However, we are not out of the woods yet and can lower our guard. The answer of recent history is those who have been blessed with the confidence and determination to resolve many complex issues which have afflicted our small nation. Indeed, we have been very fortunate to have had a series of very gifted and astute political leaders who have seen us through many, many dark times. Our present leaders are no exception. I would like to thank the Chief Minister for his outstanding leadership and his heartfelt commitment to saving lives. I also wish to thank all the government ministers for their vital role during these unprecedented times. It has been very gratifying and reassuring to see the leader of the opposition working with and supporting the government during this very difficult period. I thank your members for this. And I also thank all members of the opposition for their important contribution. I also thank the Honourable Lady. The community as a whole has welcomed this display of unity in the face of such adversity. I believe we would not have achieved this surprising degree of success in combating the virus had it not been for the fact that in the greatest time of need, the whole community has stepped up to the plate. With the evidence of the tough lockdown measures have greatly contributed to this success. Our community's sense of responsibility and duty has once again come to the fore. In the outset of this emergency, the DHA worked round the clock to ensure that we were as prepared as possible to deal with this very real prospect of an onslaught from the deadly virus, from the deadly virus. This took me back to June of last year when I became critically ill with viral meningitis and spent some time in the ICU. I was told I was intubated on a ventilator with everyone, including my family, we are required to wear PPE. This has brought home the fact that our doctors and nurses face the threat to their health and well-being, not only at the time of a national health emergency, but on a daily. I want to thank the Director of Public Health and the Acting Medical Director for their invaluable service in preventing and considerable potential loss of life. To public health devotion, to the frontline and intended staff and the DHA, EOS and other care entities, who have been at the coldest, day and night, and at great personal risk of serious. Without your expertise, dedication, and sacrifice, things could have turned out very differently. Gibraltar owes you a huge debt of gratitude. I would like to publicly recognize the valuable work undertaken by the RDP, DDP Customs, Border and Coast Guard, and teachers, as well as all those other persons whose professions and jobs have also put them in harm's way. I want to thank the civil and public services for the crucial role they have played in this emergency. I also extend my thanks to CBS and the Royal Gibraltar Regiment and to the many volunteers. Last but not least, I wish to convey my thanks to the civil community unit for coordinating the necessary action to deal with this major emergency. The number of deaths worldwide and the possibility of this virus may continue to rear its deadly head and brought into sharp focus the quality of life in the world we now live in. We are so privileged to live in Gibraltar and to have such an excellent health service. Same time we've said in many other countries, let us not forget what we have and not take anything for granted. As the lockdown measures begin to ease, we should continue to act responsibly and observe the basic health hygiene requirements and the need for social distancing. The virus is lurking out there, ready to come whenever we lower our guard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of all members for your very touching and kind, very heartfelt words. I think that you have spoken to all of us in the way that you have addressed us today. I am so glad that you are here and well. I really don't know in whose hands I would now put myself. I know there's one that would not get the chance anymore, and maybe with an obligator, it would be him to do. And later today, Mr. Speaker, we'll have an opportunity to hear from another one of the over 70-year cohort who will be in more obviously robust mode than any of us younger saplings, and against whom I dare say the virus never stood a chance. And I adjourn, I move Mr. Speaker, the House will now adjourn to 4:00 PM in the afternoon to continue with the
committee. The House will now adjourn to 4:00 PM in the afternoon.